land of the free. Has anything changed at all? Sweet liberty.
Listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. It is Wednesday, and it is the first day of November in the year 2006. We're ready to go into 2007, aren't we, folks? Our spiritual message this evening is from A Course in Miracles. It's from the text, page 119. Rest in His love and protect your rest by loving. I'll do that again. Rest in His love and protect your rest by loving. Ten words. And it says everything, doesn't it, folks? Tonight, I was actually going to do something else, and this happens often, that I change my mind at the last moment. I have information here. Actually, it's from the HarperCollins Atlas of World History, and it's written by the New World Order gang. So it pretty much tells everything. And I was going to share with you this evening their section on the U.S., the United States. It doesn't say America, of course. It's the United States. That is because the United States is not America's government. It is a corporation. And it is actually the United States rise to a world power but anyway, I'll probably do that next week. I got to thinking about the wars and how they treat their what they called our fine men and women in uniform. I don't know how many of you are aware of the situation with the USS Indianapolis. And I'm going to share that with you this evening. We did it a long time ago when I first discovered it. And what made me, I had never heard about it. Something we never learned in history in school, of course. But I remember when watching the movie Jaws and the captain of the boat that went out to get the big white whale. And he told about when he was on the USS Indianapolis and how the ship went down and they were left there in shark-infested waters. And he told how the men were being picked off one by one as they waited to be rescued. And it occurred to me long after that, I guess long after that, once I became aware of so much more than I was at the time the movie Jaws was out, I got to wondering if there was any truth to that story, and I did some research. And I found it. And I printed it out here tonight. I've been meaning to send this to Darren to put on our website at sweetliberty.org. I may have done it, but I don't think so because I know it isn't posted. Here's a little history on the USS Indianapolis. The world's first operational atomic bomb was delivered by the Indianapolis. Now that sentence to me tells everything. Why those men were left to die, hopefully that they were all going to die. The world's first operational atomic bomb was delivered by the Indianapolis to the island of Tinian on 26th of July, 1945. The Indianapolis then reported to CINCPAC, that's Commander-in-Chief Pacific, CINCPAC, headquarters at Guam. Okay, let me start that over. The Indianapolis then reported to to ThinkPAC headquarters at Guam for further orders. This was after they delivered the bomb. She was directed to join the battleship USS Idaho at Leyte Gulf, L-E-Y-T-E, Gulf in the Philippines, to prepare for the invasion of Japan. The Indianapolis, unescorted, departed Guam on a course of 262 degrees, making about 17 knots. And that was the first time that a ship, maybe they tell it in here, I read so much, I won't do a lot of commenting because maybe I'll comment and it's in this report, folks. At 14 minutes past midnight on 30th July, 1945, midway between Guam and Leyte Gulf, she was hit by two torpedoes out of six fired by the 158, or I-58 maybe, a Japanese submarine. The first blew away the bow of the ship. The second struck near midship on the starboard side, adjacent to a fuel tank and a powder magazine. The resulting explosion split the ship to the keel, knocking out all electrical power. Within minutes, she went down rapidly by the bow, rolling to starboard. This was midnight. It was black out there, folks. Of the 1,196 aboard, about 900 made it into the water in the 12 minutes before she sank. 1,196. 900 made it into the water in the 12 minutes before she sank. Few life rafts were released. Most survivors wore the standard KPOC life jacket. Shark attacks began with sunrise of the first day and continued until the men were physically removed from the water almost 5 days later. Shortly after 11 a.m. of the fourth day, the survivors were accidentally discovered by Lieutenant Wilbur Gwynn piloting his PV-1 Ventura bomber on routine anti-submarine patrol. Radioing his base at Peleliu, he alerted many men in the water. A PBY seaplane under the command of Lieutenant Adrian Marks was dispatched to lend assistance and report. En route to the scene, Marks overflew the destroyer USS Cecil Doyle and alerted her captain of the emergency. The captain of the Doyle, on his own authority, decided to divert to the scene. Arriving hours ahead of the Doyle, Mark's crew began dropping rubber rafts and supplies. While so engaged, they observed men being attacked by sharks. Disregarding standing orders not to land at sea, Mark's landed and began taxiing to pick up the stragglers and lone swimmers who were at greatest risk of shark attack. Learning the men were the crew of the Indianapolis, he radioed the news requesting immediate assistance. The Doyle responded she was en route. As complete darkness fell, Marks waited for help to arrive, all the while continuing to seek out and pull nearly dead men from the water. When the plane's fuselage was full, survivors were tied to the wing with parachute cord. Marks and his crew rescued 56 men that day. The Cecil Doyle was the first vessel on the scene. Homing on Mark's PBY, the seaplane, in total darkness, the Doyle halted to avoid killing or further injuring survivors. And began taking Mark's survivors aboard. Disregarding the safety of his own vessel, the Doyle's captain pointed his largest searchlight into the night sky to serve as a beacon for other rescue vessels. The beacon was the first indication to most survivors that their prayers had been answered. 5 days in the water, folks. Help had at last arrived. Of the 900 who made it into the water, only 317 of them remained alive. After almost 5 days of constant shark attacks, starvation, terrible thirst, suffering from exposure and their wounds, the men of the Indianapolis were at last rescued from the sea. The impact of this unexpected disaster sent shockwaves of hushed disbelief throughout Navy circles in the South Pacific. A public announcement of the loss of the Indianapolis was delayed for almost 2 weeks until August 15th, thus ensuring that would be overshadowed in the news on the day when the Japanese surrender was announced by President Truman. Did you get that, folks? They announced this tragedy, making sure that it would be overshadowed by the news that VJ Day had come. The Navy, however, was rushing to gather the facts and to determine who was responsible for the greatest sea disaster in its history, who, in effect, to blame. It was a faulty rush to judgment. Evidence was withheld. It is important to note at the outset that the vital information pertinent to determining responsibility for the loss of the Indianapolis was not made public until long after the subsequent court-martial and conviction of Captain McVeigh. He was the captain of the USS Indianapolis. U.S. intelligence, using a top-secret operation labeled ULTRA, U-L-T-R-A, had broken the Japanese code and was aware. Now listen to this, folks. U.S. intelligence was aware that two Japanese submarines, including the I-58, were operating in the path of the Indianapolis. This information was classified and not made available to either the court-martial board or to Captain McVeigh's defense counsel. It did not become known until the early 1990s that, despite knowledge of the danger in its path, naval authorities at Guam had sent the Indianapolis into harm's way without any warning. And listen to this, folks, refusing her captain's request for a destroyer escort and leading him to believe that his route was safe. They sent him right into the nest. Captain McVeigh's request for a destroyer escort was denied, despite the fact that no capital ship lacking anti-submarine detection equipment such as the Indianapolis had made this transit across the Philippine Sea without an escort during the entire war. Captain McVeigh was not told that shortly before his departure from Guam, a Japanese submarine within range of his path had sunk a destroyer escort, the USS Underhill. Shortly after the Indianapolis was sunk, naval intelligence decoded a message from the I-58 to its headquarters in Japan that it had sunk an American battleship along the route of the Indianapolis. The message was ignored. Naval authorities then and now have maintained that the Indianapolis sank too quickly to send out a distress signal. A radioman aboard the Indianapolis testified at the September 1999 Senate hearing, however, that he watched the needle jump on the ship's transmitter, indicating that a distress signal was transmitted minutes before the ship sank. And sources at three separate locations have indicated they were aware of a distress signal being received from the sinking ship. It's very likely that these distress signals were received but ignored as the Japanese tripped to lure rescue vessels to the area. Confusion on the part of Navy communications and a faulty directive caused the failure of the Indianapolis to arrive on schedule to go unnoticed. Confusion. This is as much as they're telling, folks. You can see here that the way some of these sentences are worded that they're covering. Listen to this. Confusion on the part of Navy communications and a faulty directive caused the failure of the Indianapolis to arrive on schedule to go unnoticed. They didn't even notice that it hadn't arrived, that it was 5 days late, folks. Leaving as many as 900 men at the mercy of a shark-infected sea. And in parentheses, this says, the faulty directive, which required only reporting the arrival of non-combatant ships, was corrected days after the Indianapolis survivors were discovered to require reporting the arrival of combatant ships as well. A hastily convened closed-door court of inquiry had been convened in Guam on August 13th with the judge advocate, prosecutor, Captain William Hilbert, stating that they were, quote, starting the proceedings without having available all the necessary data. Little was done to add such data prior to the court's decision. As the first witness, Captain McVeigh was asked, among other things, whether he had been zigzagging the night the ship was sunk. His answer was simply, no, sir. But apparently little weight was given to the fact that he was under orders to zigzag at his own discretion. Testimony by survivors that visibility was severely limited the night of the attack, thus explaining Captain McVeigh's orders to cease zigzagging, was heard but never considered again, either then or at the subsequent court-martial. The surface operations officer at Guam, who had sent the Indianapolis across the Philippine Sea without a destroyer escort, and who was responsible for advising Captain McVeigh of any perils in his path, testified that the danger was, quote, practically negligible. It is very likely that the surface operation officer was indeed aware of the dangers in the path of the Indianapolis revealed by the ultra code breaking, but not known to the court-martial board. Thus, his testimony that the dangers were practically negligible had the self-serving impact of diverting attention from his own culpability for not heeding Captain McVeigh's request for a destroyer escort. The Court of Inquiry ultimately recommended that Captain McVeigh be court-martialed on two vague charges. Number one, culpable inefficiency in the performance of his duties, and two, negligently endangering the lives of others. Over 350 Navy warships had been lost in combat during World War II, but none of their captains had been court-martialed. Both Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz and Vice Admiral Raymond Spruance, for whom the Indianapolis served as 5th Fleet flagship, opposed court-martialing Captain McVeigh, and never had an officer been court-martialed over the objection of his superiors, much less such prominent flag officers. With the war ended, the scene then shifted to Washington. When orders were given to proceed with the court-martial of Captain McVeigh, only days before the trial actually began on December 3rd at the Washington Navy Yard, he and his defense counsel learned for the first time of the charges against him. The Navy, finally, had decided on two charges against Captain McVeigh. There was no evidence to substantiate the first charge, which was failure to issue timely orders to abandon ship. The fact that it was even lodged against him was curious. Well before the trial began, the Navy was aware that the torpedo attack had knocked out the ship's electrical system and that orders to abandon ship could only be shouted by word of mouth in the din and confusion aboard the sinking ship. The second charge against Captain McVeigh was that he had hazarded his ship by failing to zigzag in good visibility. Here are the facts which made this charge shamefully unjust. The orders which Captain McVeigh received in Guam directed him to zigzag at his discretion. No Navy directive in existence, then or now, requires zigzagging at night in limited visibility. The charge against Captain McVeigh stated that the visibility was good on the night of the sinking, a fact never contested by the inexperienced defense counsel, who was assigned to Captain McVey. When Captain McVey issued orders to cease zigzagging shortly before midnight, the visibility, according to all eyewitnesses aboard the ship, was and remained very poor up to the time of the torpedo struck. So bad that crew members could not identify their shipmates several yards away. Statements taken by survivors immediately after rescue that the visibility was severely limited were not made available as evidence at the court-martial and only recently surfaced as the result of research into old Navy records. The commander of the Japanese submarine, which sank the Indianapolis and who testified at the court-martial, said that he could have sunk the ship whether it had been zigzagging or not. A decorated U.S. submarine commander testified at the court-martial that, given the identical circumstances which faced the Japanese submarine that night, he could have sunk the Indianapolis, whether it had been zigzagging or not. And so, the Navy court-martial found Captain Charles Butler McVey III guilty of hazarding his ship by failure to zigzag in good visibility, thus diverting attention from so many others whose negligence and misjudgments were the real cause of this tragedy. Well, do you think it was negligence and misjudgment, folks, realizing that this ship delivered, I didn't know it delivered the bomb, I thought it delivered a final component that the bomb, they needed to have the bomb totally completed. And I don't buy it that it was negligence and misjudgment. And it damaged his promising naval career beyond repair. In early 2000, only months before his death, at the age of 91 in Kyoto, Japan, the commander of the Japanese submarine, which sank the Indianapolis, gave an interview, and referring to Captain McVey's court-martial at which he had been a witness, he said, "I had a feeling it was contrived from the beginning." That is the story. It remains a tarnish on the reputation of the United States Navy more than half a century later, and it will remain a stain on the conscience of the Navy. I don't know how that makes you feel. It is so tragic, so sad to think of all of those individuals, folks, all of them. And they believed that they were in that war to protect and defend their country. And we're going to talk about that next week, too. The benefit to the United States of every war that has ever been fought to make it the superpower that it is today. I've got another piece here, and this is about the Indianapolis. And this is Woody Eugene James. And he was one of the survivors. This is his story. And this brings it home. It's more than just a bunch of words on a page, a bunch of statistics. This is in his own words. Woody Eugene James was born November 13, 1922, in Gilbertown, Alabama. He joined the Navy September 11, 1942, so he was 20 years old. In June of 1943, he was assigned to the USS Indianapolis 1st Division. Sunday, the 29th of July, was a quiet day. The sea was running five or six, these are his words now. The sea was running 5 or 6 feet waves, just a beautiful day out. Didn't do too much, read a book, did a little tinkering as usual. Had the 8 to 12 watch and just got off at midnight. A guy relieved me about 11:45. I went down through the galley and had a cup of coffee. then went to my compartment, got a blanket off my bed, and went back up on deck. I slept under the overhang on the first turret. My battle station was inside it, so in case general quarters sounded, I slept underneath it. Just got laid down, using my shoes for a pillow as usual, and the first torpedo hit. I was up and down between the deck and the overhang of the turret like Yankee Doodle Dandy, and I wondered, what in the hell is going on? I got out of my blanket and started to roll out from underneath the turret, and the other torpedo hit, another Yankee Doodle deal, all over the place. I started to walk forward to see what I could see, and what I had seen was about 60 foot of the bow chopped off, completely gone. Within a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes at the most, the bow was starting to go down. It filled up with water that fast. Everything was open below deck, and the water just flooded in, and we were still underway, just scooping water. Complete chaos, total and complete chaos all over the whole ship. Screams like you couldn't believe, and nobody knew what was going on. The word got passed down, abandoned ship. It was maybe 5 minutes, and we were really down in the water, so we proceeded to abandon ship. Jim Newhall and I went over the side holding hands. I got tangled up in the lifeline alongside the ship. I got untangled and surfaced. I'm all alone, so I swam out away from the ship, probably 50 yards, maybe 100 yards, I don't know. I flipped over on my back and looked back, and about two-thirds of the ship was in the water, bow first and leaning to the right. The propellers were still turning. In the silhouette of the sinking ship, I could see guys jumping off the fantail like crazy. I went over the side with the life jacket. I pulled it off and gave it to one of the younger officers that was screaming his head off that he didn't have one. Anyway, there I am laying on my back looking at that, and no life jacket. I don't hear anybody around me anyplace, so I'm just kind of floating and relaxing, when lo and behold, a potato crate floats by. Potatoes were packaged in wooden crates then. It was just an empty potato crate, made of good buoyancy to hold on to. Works as well, as good as the life jacket, I guess. Then pretty soon, I heard some voices. I yelled, and who answers me? My buddy, Jim Newhall. So I swam over to where he was, and there was quite a group of them. It's chaos, and everybody talking, and a lot of the guys were wounded, burned, and we were trying to do the best we could. Day one. The next morning, we've kind of counted heads as best we could. There was about 150 people in the group. We were scattered around quite a bit. Well, this isn't too bad, we thought. We'll be picked up today. They knew we were out here after all. We were due in the Philippines this morning at 11 o'clock, so when we don't show, they'll know. If they didn't get a message off, but we're sure they got a message off, they'll still know where we are, so no sweat. We'll be picked up before the day's over. So the day passed. Night came, and it was cold. It was cold. The next morning, the sun come up and warmed things up, and then it got unbearably hot. So you start praying for the sun to go down so you can cool off again. We're going to take a break here, folks, for about 3 minutes. And we'll be able to finish this well before we're over, done with tonight. I don't know. This really happened. And while you're hearing this, if you've never read this report, put yourself in their places. Think of being there, literally being there, in that cold, dark ocean, waiting to be picked up. It's war. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay with us, huh?
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Sometimes our .com server goes down, so don't forget, we have a backup, FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
And you'll receive an MP3 CD as a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you read the history books, the most often asked question to Southerners was this: why did you fight? And the most often given answer is, because you're here. In other words, the South did not invade the North invaded the South.
Was it the Civil War or War of Federal Aggression? John Weaver sets the record straight in this DVD series on the Civil War from the Old Pass Christian History Conference. Was there a war to set the slaves free? Or was it a war to enslave us all? Get this DVD and judge for yourself. War of Federal Aggression. Get this DVD presentation for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Call 559-781-3773. The truth seems strange only because we've been indoctrinated with a fiction. War of Federal Aggression. Get it today.
All right, we're back, folks. If you happen to tune in late. Oh, can you? That's okay, honey. Okay. If you happen to tune in late, what I'm doing right now, we were talking about the USS Indianapolis, and I'm sharing with you now a survivor's story. I'm going to start over with day one. They went into the water at midnight, right around midnight. And on day one, this is Woody James, a 21-year-old man, who he was 21 years old when this all happened to him. So day one, he said the next morning we kind of counted heads, the best we could do. There was about 150 people in the group. We were scattered around quite a bit. Well, this isn't too bad, we thought. We'll be picked up today. They knew we were out here after all. We were due in the Philippines this morning at 11 o'clock, so when we don't show, they'll know. If they didn't get a message off, but we're sure they got a message off, they'll still know where we are. So no sweat. We'll be picked up before the day's over. So the day passed. Night came and it was cold. It was cold. The next morning the sun came up and warmed things up, and then it got unbearably hot. So you start praying for the sun to go down so you can cool off again. Day two. When the sharks showed up, in fact they showed up the afternoon before, but I didn't know of anybody being bit. Maybe one on the second day, but We just know we'll be picked up today. They've got it all organized by now. They'll be out here pretty soon and get us. We all fought. The day wore on and the sharks were around. Come nighttime and nobody showed up. We had another night of cold, praying for the sun to come up. What a long night. Day three, the sun finally did rise, and it got warmed up again. Some of the guys been drinking salt water by now, and they were going berserk. They'd tell you big stories about the Indianapolis is not sunk. It's just right there under the surface. I was just down there and had a drink of water out of the drinking fountain. And the Gee-Dunk is still open. The Gee-Dunk being the commissary where you buy ice cream, cigarettes, candy, what have you. It's still open, they tell you. Come on, we'll go get a drink of water. And then three or four guys would believe this story and go with them. The day wore on and the sharks were around, hundreds of them. You'd hear guys scream, especially late in the afternoon. Seemed like the sharks were the worst late in the afternoon than they were during the day. Then they fed at night, too. Everything would be quiet, and then you'd hear somebody scream, and you knew a shark had got him. It didn't ever get any cooler in the daytime. In fact, Newhall asked me, he said, James, do you think it's any hotter in hell than it is here? I said, I don't know, Jim, but if it is, I ain't going. We were hungry, thirsty, no water, no food, no sleep, getting dehydrated, waterlogged, and more of the guys were going berserk. There was fights going on, so Jim and I decided, the heck with this, we'll get away from this bunch before we get hurt. So he and I kind of drifted off by ourselves. We tied our life jackets together so we'd stay together. Jim was in pretty good shape to begin with, but he was burned like crazy. His hand was burned. He couldn't hold on to anything, couldn't touch anything. Day four. Then the next day arrived. By this time, I would have given my front seat in heaven and walked the rotten log all the way through hell for just one cool drink of water. My mouth was so dry, it was like cotton. Howie got up enough nerve to take a mouthful of salt water and rinse my mouth out and spit it out. I don't know, but I did. Did it a couple of times before the morning was over. That's probably why I ended up with salt water ulcers in my throat. When we got picked up, my throat was bigger than my head. Anyway, we're out there in the sun praying for it to go down again. Then, lo and behold, there's a plane. Of course, there had been planes every day since day one. They were real high. And some of the floaters had mirrors that tried to attract them, but nothing. Anyway, this one showed up and flew by, and we thought, oh, hell, he didn't see us either. He's gone. And then we seen him turn and come back, and we knew we had been spotted. What a relief that was. This was an accident, folks. You see, it was an accident that they were found. It wasn't because the Navy sent out their search party, was it? So, he did. He came back and flew over us. It was the little PV-1 Ventura. It was out on submarine patrol and he spotted us. He radioed back to his base and insisted, instead of sending some help out, the Navy sent one plane out, one PBY, that came out and circled and radioed back to the base that there was a bunch of people in the water and he needed more assistance and more survival gear. The pilot ended up landing in the water and picked up a lot of guys, the single guys, one or two guys that were together, so the afternoon went on. Late in the afternoon before dark, there was another PBY on the scene. He dropped his survival gear, and he dropped a little three-man rubber raft. Jim and I tried to swim to it. He made it, but I didn't. I was just sore out from holding him up and hanging on to him all day and the night before. I just couldn't make it, but he did. By the time he got on it, there were two other guys, so there's three of them total in it, and that's all it was made for, three. Anyway, the other direction, there was two guys in the water, and the two guys in the raft told Jim, we'll go over there and pick those two up. Jim said, no, we're going to go pick Woody up, then we'll go get those two guys. They said, nope, we're going to do it the other way. The raft contained those little aluminum oars that come in two pieces, and Jim put one of them together and threw the other one overboard. He said, okay, you guys, I don't want to be mean, but we're going over to get Woody, and you guys are going to do the paddling by hand. If you don't, things are going to happen with this oar that you ain't going to like. So they came over and picked me up, and that's how I owed Jim Newhall my life. If it had not been for that, I wouldn't be here telling this story. And, of course, he didn't make much out of the fact that he had been holding Jim up all that time, did he, folks? So they picked me up, and then we went and got the other two guys. Now there's six of us on this raft. It's getting pretty crowded, but we run onto three other guys, and we pick them up. Now there's nine of us on this little raft. It's just about dark, and figure we'll make it through the night one way or another. About midnight, a little bit before, there was a light shining off the bottom of the cloud, and we knew then we were saved. That was the spotlight of the Cecil Doyle. The Navy is on the scene. There's a ship coming. You can't believe how happy we were. Guys screaming and yelling, we're saved, we're saved. And now we're to the morning of the fifth day here. He said the Doyle arrived on the scene and started picking survivors out of the water a little after midnight. It was daylight the next morning that he came alongside us in our little raft. Boy, what a happy day that was to get my feet on the deck again. We got on deck, saluted the officer of the day, and asked permission to come aboard, which was Navy tradition. All I had on was my boatswain pipe hanging around my neck on a lanyard, and I pulled it off and gave it to one of these guys. Why? I don't know. Just happy to give anything I own for being rescued, I guess. Anyway, they gave me one spoonful of sweetened water and assigned a guy to get me cleaned up because we were all covered with oil. Had been oily for a day, which was a blessing. Had we not had the oil on us like we did, sun would have really ruined us. It was a good thing we had the oil on. So I went to the shower and got cleaned up as best I could. I asked the guy, is this fresh water, shower, or salt? He said, fresh. I turned my head up to it and opened my mouth, and I tried to drink that shower dry. Got off what we could, junk off of me. And they gave us clothes, dungarees, of course, and found us a bed. All the crew was just the nicest people in the world. They gave up their beds and everything. I went asleep laying on my back. Unbeknownst to me, I noticed when I was showering that my legs were burned. Both legs were burned in the back, halfway between the thigh and the knee, to halfway between the knee and the ankle. I went to sleep and didn't see the doctor. They had one doctor aboard and a couple of quartermen, but they had more important things to do than take care of me. There was a lot of people in worse shape than I was, but they tried to help. I went to sleep. I don't know how long I slept. I went to sleep with my knees drawn up in the bed on my back. I waked up, and all that burn had matted together, and I couldn't straighten my legs. So I spent the rest of my time until I got aboard the hospital ship on a stretcher. They wanted to move me around, so they put me on a stretcher. Got aboard the hospital ship, and 3 days later, my legs are still bent and matted together. I remember going aboard the hospital ship. They hoisted us aboard, and I was still on the stretcher. The doctor was standing on the deck directing traffic. This one goes to the emergency room, and this one goes to the ward. And it got to me, and he sent me to the emergency room. I got in there, and they laid me on the operating table on my stomach, started to give me a shot. I said, "Doc, no shot. It ain't going to hurt any worse than it hurts already. So if you got something to do, you do it." The doc said, "Do it to you, son." And the nurse handed me a folded-up towel, a wet towel, and said, "You better hang on to this." The doctor put one hand on my ankle, one hand on my buttocks, and straightened my leg, and I thought my head would go through the roof. And as weak as I was, I just about twisted that towel in two. And then he did the same thing to the other leg, and they picked all the scabs off with tweezers, laid gauze on it, and put some kind of ointment on it, and it stayed that way. They changed it every few hours and put stuff on it again. This was in the morning before noon. Then we spent the rest of that day and that night and the next day and the next night aboard the Tranquility. We got into Guam to a naval hospital. They transferred us off the ship over to the hospital. We was there for 5 weeks or so, and they would tweezer my legs and put gauze and ointment on several times. To this day, I don't know what they used on it, but I have no scars. On the back of one leg, I have a scar that's maybe an inch long. That's the only thing I have from it. They finally discharged us all from the hospital. They kept us all in the hospital, the whole crew, until everybody was able to move out. And then they moved us down to what they called submarine R&R camp. We thought we'd died and gone to heaven. This is not the Navy. You go to bed when you want, get up when you want. You go over to the kitchen and tell the cook what you want to eat, how you want it fixed. It's like a downtown cafe. Well, I was discharged on the third day of December, 45, and that was the end of my Navy career. I'm glad. I don't want to do it again. But if I had to, I would, even at my age, I would gladly serve my country again. If I had to do it again, even at my age, I would gladly serve my country again. My granddaddy had a lot of sayings. He'd always tell me, "Son, do right by your fellow man. Treat him as you'd like to be treated, because your chickens will come home to roost. You reap what you sow. Sow good things, and you reap good things." I must have sowed some good seeds somewhere along the line. I've sure been harvesting good things. Found and married the woman I love with a ready-made family. A lot of people don't get to choose their kids, but I did. It's been a joy in my life. I dearly love each one of them. Today, 50 years later, there's 32 grandkids and 46 great-grandkids. Now, that's a bunch of little rascals. We had a lot of good years together, had a lot of good times. Some of it wasn't so good. Sometimes we struggled. Sometimes it was better. But we've always been together. Do I know how to plant seed, or do I know how to plant seed? I live in a house beside the road, and I hope I've been a friend to man. Else here, folks. I think we might have time to do it. Is that sad? The man went through what he went through. And he said, I would gladly do it again because I would be glad to serve my country again. And they were left out there, and they were left out there on purpose, and they were sent into a nest of submarines, or the Japanese submarine, without an escort, and it was all done intentionally. And that's what's so sad. And I think about those young people. Well, they're not all young, but the people that go into the service, and somehow they've been convinced that they're over there. They're over in Iraq, killing women and children, people. Think about what's happening in Iraq. Think about it happening here in America. And they believe that they're over there defending their country. And their minds are just, they've been totally lost, haven't they? Okay, this is, you've heard this before, well, some of you have. This is the War Prayer. It's by Mark Twain. Excuse my nasal here. This is the War Prayer. I read this a long time ago when the second Iraqi, I don't even know how we could call it a war. It's just a slaughter is what it is. And it's killing innocent people. And of course all the people in Iraq who are fighting against the foreign invaders into their country are called insurgents and rebels. And then the people here in America who hear the news, they probably cheer every time some more insurgents are killed. Okay, let me do this. The War Prayer by Mark Twain. It was a time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast, burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating, the bands playing, the toy pistols popping, the bunched firecrackers hissing and spluttering. On every hand, and for down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Well, today, the Zionist-inspired patriots are flying American flags made in China, aren't they, folks? Proudly. Daily, the young volunteers march down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms. The proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened panting to patriot oratory, which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, and which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to flag and country, and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause, in outpourings of fervid eloquence, which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war and cast a doubt upon its righteousness straightaway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way. Sunday morning came. Next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender, and then home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor there to win for the flag, or failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament, the Old Testament, was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse, the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation, God the All-Terrible, Thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it, for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid, comfort, encourage them in their patriotic work, bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril, bear them in his mighty hand, make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset, help them to crush the foe, grant to them and to their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless step up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued with his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal, Bless our arms, grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag. The stranger touched his arm, motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did, and he took his place. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes, in which burned an uncanny light. Then in a deep voice, he said, I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God. The words smote the house with a shock. If the stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it. Oh, ha. You know what? I'm just going to quit right here. I am so sorry, folks. I thought I'd have time to read this before we were done. I'm going to do this next week, probably, unless something else comes up. We're out of our hour right now, and we have to go. Thank you for being here tonight. And maybe instead of our hearts filled with anger and hatred, our hearts can be filled with love. Love for what is right, what is good. We'll see you next Wednesday, folks. Good night.
Who are you? That is the question, and the name of the program. To learn what the question means and what the answers are, tune in every Sunday afternoon.